Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yes, we are back on deck. Lockdown didn't actually lift here yet, so we are now into our third week of lockdown in my region, but I took last week off anyway and hung out with my kids, and that was all a lot of fun. But with any luck, you know, it'll all be changing in a few days for me because I do live in a regional area, so fingers crossed. I'm definitely, though, sparing a thought for all the listeners in Melbourne and Sydney who are also locked down. The good news is the vaccine program here in Australia is finally in full swing, so with any luck, things will be getting a little bit more normal soon. And also my thoughts to listeners in New Zealand who are also locked down. There's a lot of lockdown happening in APAC right now. And yeah, news from overseas has shown us that, you know, genuine normal is a way off, but hopefully in a couple of months from now, things will at least be a bit different, a little bit more normal. So just hang on, everyone, and we'll get through this. We'll be joined by Adam Boileau in just a moment to talk through all the security news of the last couple of weeks. And yeah, there is a fair bit to get through there, not surprisingly. And then we'll hear from this week's sponsor, which is Trail of Bits, the security engineering firm. Evan Saltanek and Dan Guido will be joining us to talk about Fickling, a tool developed by Trail of Bits to do weird things to the Python pickle files that are heavily used as a means to share machine learning models. The machine learning supply chain is a little bit wobbly looking, and they'll be joining us to talk about all of that. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it's time to talk about the security news that we missed over the last couple of weeks with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, why do telcos suck so badly at InfoSec? It's really just great. Like, they're so bad. T-Mobile has managed to lose a lot of info, man. Like, it just sort of started turning up in forums, and they're like, wait, what?
Yes, the reports are that they've lost a whole bunch of data. I mean, up to, I mean, we've seen numbers of like 50 million customers, 100 million customers, depending on who you ask, you know, the attacker or the telco. And that's, you know, data about subscribers, you know, SSNs and other kind of, you know, personal information, details about the mobiles like the MZs and IMEI numbers and stuff, which you can use to identify individual handsets and subscribers, and just the whole bunch of data. And I mean, it's certainly not the first time we've seen a telco get compromised, because as you say, telcos do unfortunately kind of suck. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. I mean, I think, you know, one of them is that the telco is the historic enemy of our people, and that we, you know, we, the hackers, learned hacking to hack into the telco. So there's quite a lot of, you know, of shared history of this industry.
So this is a cultural thing in your view.
It's a cultural thing. Yes, exactly. And I haven't seen concrete details about what exactly how they got in, but there was some scuttlebutt floating around that it was a like telnet interface on like a test piece of mobile network equipment, like an SGSN or something.
You mean it was highly like, sophisticated?
I mean, like, highly sophisticated, you know, change B123 or something, you know, as the root password for a piece of gear that you could get to across the network. So, and then pivoted onwards from there. And certainly if you've ever been in a telco Unix environment, then, you know, pivoting onwards, not exactly a challenge.
But it's amazing anyway that we ever let these companies handle our communications. You know what I mean? Because like the sort of stuff that owns them, that gets them owned, you can't imagine that happening to like WhatsApp, you know, or Signal, right? Like, it's just the bar is so much higher now, and you just think, what are you, why?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, part of that is that, you know, this is, you know, these are networks that have been running constantly for 30, 40 years in some cases, right? And outages are difficult and change control is difficult, and the engineering team are used to a closed network and a trusted environment, are not used to, you know, the internet, whereas, you know, a Signal or a WhatsApp built from the ground up for a really hostile environment. So, you know, you can kind of see why. But as you say, like, we let these people carry our calls in the clear and our text messages in the clear, and we trust them to be the identity route for all of our multi-factor, you know, via SMS or whatever, and, you know, password reset and everything else. They have a really important role to play in the, you know, in the identity ecosystem, perhaps even more important these days, given, you know, SIM swapping and all that kind of thing, than, you know, the fact that all the comms are in the clear, you know.
But I mean,
unless you're a SIGINT agency.
I remember like before SIM swapping was really a thing, we would talk about that on this show and say all you're doing with SMS 2FA for important accounts is pushing you know, is pushing the responsibility onto a telco help desk, and that's not really going to be tenable. And lo and behold,
here we are,
right? But they actually did use the line highly sophisticated. It was a highly sophisticated attack, which makes it very funny that you're telling me it's Telnet. Yeah, that's I hadn't heard that, but that's gold. Meanwhile, you know, the United States government managed to leave its no-fly list of 1.9 million records just sitting in an old Elasticsearch, which is pretty funny. And I got to make the joke on Twitter. I wonder if these alleged terrorists are now going to get free credit monitoring provided by the US government. Quite the moral dilemma here.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're probably already being monitored, so I guess they just need to extend that to...
Maybe they could just do an organization-wide deal for Al-Qaeda members.
Yes, kind of bulk purchasing, exactly. Yeah. Good plan. This one was funny because the database in question was on like an IP that geolocates to Bahrain.
Of course.
So I guess they must have shared it with someone. I mean, this is a database that's obviously been kicking around for a long time, so... You know, I mean, in terms of there being a no-fly list, you know, since 9/11, and they've shared it around all over the place so that people can use it. But yeah, in this case, identified by some bulk internet scanning in Bahrain.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it makes perfect sense when you think about it that the FBI no-fly list was being hosted on an Elasticsearch in Bahrain.
Apparently it took, what, 3 weeks from when it got reported by someone who'd spotted it before that server got taken down. So lightning fast reflexes there too.
I mean, it's a funny story, but you can't imagine there's all that much impact going to come from it, you know?
Well, no one's flying anywhere at the moment. It's all terrorists. So,
well, they are in the Northern Hemisphere, Adam. Let's not project our reality onto others. Look, we've got an interesting story here from CyberScoop about how Facebook is working quite hard at the moment to try to shore up the security of accounts held in Afghanistan since the Taliban has retaken that country. The thinking being that the Taliban is actually quite good at infiltrating social media groups, etc., and they want to do their best to try to secure all those accounts. I mean, it is a hell of a dilemma because you think if you're Facebook and you start seeing evidence that these accounts are being infiltrated and people targeted and whatnot, you know, you'd almost think disabling Facebook in the country would be the right thing to do. But then you're sort of cutting off an information source, blah 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 blah. It's hard.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of, you know, like when we started doing this podcast, you know, which is what, 14 years ago or something for you and, you know, 10, 11 for me. This is the, you know, I never really thought that we would be talking about a story like this. And it's just a really interesting kind of sign that this stuff is really complicated. And if you're an organization, you know, like Facebook, that, you know, you do have to understand, you know, the political reality in the countries that you're serving and the lives of the people and how that impacts. And it's just a really, really kind of complicated set of issues for a private sector organization to be kind of, you know, being responsible for, you know, and I'm glad I'm not on that team because that is a hell of a responsibility.
Yeah, I think Facebook had been publicly accessible for about a year when I published the first edition of Risky Biz, maybe a little bit less. So, yeah.
It's a sign of the times, right? Jeez.
Yeah, definitely a sign of the times. Now, this one is, you know, not the sort of thing we cover. In fact, this had already happened. The first part of this story had already happened when we last recorded, but I didn't even think to include it because this stuff is just so run-of-the-mill in that world. But I'm of course, talking about the so-called $600 million crypto heist affecting Poly Networks. So someone figured out, I mean, these decentralized financial things, you know, they're basically blockchain applications, right? And they have their own types of bugs. And someone used a bug to extract $600 million in, you know, crypto magic money. And progressively just kind of trolled the people they stole the money from before giving it all back by $500,000 that they kept as a bug bounty. I mean, it's such a perfect story.
it really is a beautiful story. And the person in question, you know, has been like trolling them on the blockchain itself, like on the Ethereum blockchain, which is pretty funny. And I think, yeah, all of the money is now either back or in a dual control wallet. So both parties have to agree to remove it and the attacker is in the process of returning it. $500,000 as a reward for stealing all of their money and then giving it back in, which, you know, from an incentivization point of view, it's pretty compelling, you know, $500,000, don't do a crime, you know, just do the crime and then undo the crime and take the $500,000. And apparently they also offered him, and I don't know if this is particularly serious, offered him a job as the chief security advisor, which... Yes. I mean, it's a hell of a job interview technique. I mean, yeah.
But not? I mean, I think the thing is, what do you do with $600 million of stolen Ethereum if you're not a hardened criminal located in a bulletproof jurisdiction? You know what I mean?
Yes, like,
if
this is true. Yes.
You know, if this is some whoever sitting in Ohio or whatever, like, what are they going to do with $600 million of ETH? You can't move it around without getting sprung eventually, right?
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Like, maybe this wasn't the end game of the play, right? It wasn't what they planned to do. But hey, you accidentally steal $600 million, you're going to trip over, you know, just falls out of the truck in front of you, you know, and then you have to make some calls.
Well, and then you could just do all the trolling was fun, right? So Lorenzo at Vice Motherboard has a couple of stories up on that, and we've linked to them in this week's show notes. But staying with, you know, crypto shenanigans, I mean, yeah, a Japanese crypto exchange Liquid was hacked for $94 million worth of crypto assets. This is a Catalan Kimpanu story over at The Record.
Yep, and I mean, this just seems to be like the normal life cycle of crypto exchanges. I think this was their warm, you know, their hot wallet got hacked into through a subsidiary, stole a bunch of money. It's not the first time they've been owned. You know, this just seems kind of normal, but somehow this is the, like, number 19 by market cap, and I'm making air quotes, cryptocurrency exchange, and here they are getting hacked a second time. So
yep. Yes, they are.
Situation normal.
And yeah, look, staying with crypto, some unfortunate gentleman in Ohio has been fined $60 billion, that was last year, for operating a Bitcoin mixer called Helix, and now he has pleaded guilty to running the service. Larry Dean Harmon, 38. Yeah, so he's probably headed to prison.
Yeah, apparently he has agreed to forfeit $200 million worth of Bitcoin.
I wonder if it's all his, you know.
well, yeah, right. Which is interesting because it says, the prosecutor said that he moved, what, like $300 million worth of Bitcoin, and now he's sitting on $200 million. And obviously I think that's a function of the Bitcoin values moving around, because it said, like, they moved 350,000 Bitcoins and he only had 4,000. But
yeah, this, you know, I mean, his crimes are alleged to have occurred between 2014 and 2017. So that tracks, right?
Yeah.
I actually saw an interesting bit of news. I think it was out of Sweden. It was somewhere in that part of the world where a judge made a mistake in a ruling for a drug dealer saying that they had to pay a certain amount of money, which was equal to the value of their Bitcoins. But then while they've been in prison, Bitcoins have gone through the roof. So now the government has to give him like $2.3 million. which is pretty funny. And they're like, yeah, there's not actually anything we can do about it. So someone's going to have a very nice time upon release.
That's so funny. It's such a messed up situation, eh? So
it is. I just find this interesting, right?
Yes,
because
yes.
I think the FBI and Treasury going after these Bitcoin mixers, they are a fundamental tool, yes, used by all sorts of criminals. So taking them out of action is a terrific idea.
Yeah, we've talked a bunch about these kind of choke points that, you know, a lot of the crime proceeds do have to go through, and it makes a lot of sense to go and target those. And yeah, hitting a money laundering operation with you didn't comply with anti-money laundering things, I guess, is a pretty straightforward application of those rules. So yeah, we'll see whether this, you know, whether they go after anybody else.
Now, look, you know, according to recent comments by the Deputy National Security Advisor, Anne Neuberger, in the United States, you know, ransomware crews are going to pivot away from critical infrastructure and everything's going to be honky-dory. That's not entirely fair to Neuberger. But, you know, it seems like they've certainly cooled their jets with regard to really tackling ransomware with a gloves-off approach. But we've got a ransomware kind of wrap in this section of the show, and it's just carnage out there. So we've got a story here about the first story is about Scripps Health, which is a California-based nonprofit healthcare provider. Apparently, the ransomware attack that hit them in May this year, that company is now expected to lose $106.8 million, largely because of that attack, which is a pretty bad outcome. Further to that, we've got attacks against healthcare continuing. We've got hospitals and clinics in West Virginia and Ohio canceling surgeries, diverting ambulances, and that's due to attacks against Memorial Health System. That represents 64 clinics, including some hospitals. So those stories are from Catalin Kimpanu and Dan Gooden, respectively. Further to that, we've got a story from Emma Woollacott over at the Daily Swig talking about the St. Joseph's Candler Healthcare Network in Savannah, Georgia. They got hit on June 17th. So this is a rolling disaster for healthcare. But one of the stories that I wanted to really talk about is actually from The Verge. It's a story by Nicole Wetzman looking at a case study into the ransomware attack at the University of Vermont Health Network last year. And what they've really been able to do is look at patient outcomes in that system versus systems that weren't attacked by ransomware. And they've actually been able to draw a pretty straight line between ransomware and bad patient outcomes. And I think this is really good work, actually.
Yeah, I mean, this is really good research because, you know, it's one of those things that's intuitively obvious, right? If the computers at the hospital don't work, then probably that's going to impair the ability to give good healthcare, and that should have some outcome that's bad for patients. But, you know, that kind of common sense reasoning is much more useful when you can actually say, and here is some data that shows this. And this is an interesting study because they're using the pandemic situation and the kind of higher load overall in hospitals, which would normally, you know, kind of buffer out issues at individual hospitals because people can go to other places and there's spare capacity in the system. At this point where the system is under stress, they've got a kind of a good experimental environment to then go and look at, you know, patient outcomes during, you know, the situation, and then also, you know, ransomware attack on top. And they've managed to pull together some conclusions that, yes, in fact, it does result in, you know, meaningfully worse patient outcomes. And, you know, this kind of study is just really useful to be able to point at when, you know, we're having the conversation about, you know, whether this is acceptable and what we should do about it.
Yeah, so it looks like this is research led by Josh Corman for CSER. So it is interesting. I mean, you know, maybe these hospitals should rebrand and, you know, somehow brand themselves as oil pipelines so that the US government will take it seriously, because it certainly looks like things are not easing up against healthcare. For this week's newsletter, the newsletter goes out on Thursdays here in Australia, Australia time these days. Tom Uren is our new newsletter writer, and he's been speaking to a bunch of people who track ransomware this week to try to get an idea of whether or not targeting behavior has actually changed in the wake of the Colonial Pipeline hack and all of the tough rhetoric from the United States and its officials, right? And it looks like there have been some tiny changes, but it certainly does look like the US might be patting itself on the back a little bit prematurely. So here's Tom previewing what's going to be in tomorrow's newsletter.
I spoke to Bill Siegel at Coveware, a ransomware incident response firm, Alan Lisker at Recorded Future, which has a data set around data leaked on extortion sites, and Brett Keller at MZSoft. So they each have a different perspective on ransomware trends. When I first approached them, all of them said, nothing's changed. Trends are basically continuing unaffected. They did caveat that it's pretty early. But when they dove into the data, both Brett and Alan found that being a pivot, if not away from the US, at least a pivot towards other countries. So the percentage of data that ends up leaked on extortion sites from US companies had dropped, and countries like France and Germany had increased. Brett, with the ransomware files, had also seen an increase in countries like Australia and New Zealand. So perhaps there's early signs of a pivot away from the US, but they all said it's pretty early. They're also skeptical that focusing on gangs that offer ransomware as a service would be really effective, mostly because there's a whole lot of different gangs and it's the affiliates who do operations. And if one gang isn't willing to affect critical infrastructure, and the affiliate is, they'll just move to a different ransomware gang.
So there you go, mate. Market forces in the criminal world, right? And I think that's a really interesting point, which is if you shut down one of the ransomware as a service operators, or if you get them to behave within certain norms, the affiliates are just going to seek out different platforms to do their stuff with. So I think that's interesting work from Tom, and people can read about that tomorrow in the newsletter.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it, you know, suggests there is a range of kind of, you know, chaotic evil actors and lawful evil actors that are willing to, you know, some will take on norms, some won't, some will just attack anything they can find and then figure out a way to monetize it later. And, you know, and that range of, you know, sort of alignments you know, does mean that our ability to use norms, you know, even when they're norms on the criminal world, to control this is probably still pretty limited.
And meanwhile, there's been a spate of ransomware attacks affecting all manner of targets, including Brazil's largest clothing store chain. I'm guessing that's pronounced Lojas Renner, but my missus is going to laugh at me, no doubt. So I called it Lojas Renner. What is it?
Lojas Renner.
Yeah, they got ransomware.
Oh, that's bad.
You don't care, do you? Krebs has a story up talking about how there's people now spamming, saying, hey, if you introduce ransomware into your, you know, employer's environment, we'll share the loot with you. Looks like these are pretty low-grade scammers, right? But one thing I find interesting is that a lot of the media are running with this as like, this is the first time that's ever happened. But don't forget, there was a guy arrested for trying to bribe a Tesla employee into ransomwearing Tesla. You remember that? He got... So this is not the first time, and this is absolutely something that will eventually happen.
Yeah, I one of the things that the story, I mean, there's two things that were funny in the story. One was that this particular case, which was turned out to be a Nigerian guy that was doing the scamming, so it's kind of like mixing up the business email compromise and traditional Nigerian prints kind of forward payment scams to, you know, say, hey, we'll pay you 40% if you ransom it. Kind of like, that's pretty generous.
Yeah, but anyway, it's also but the pretty bullshit.
Well, yeah, but it turns out the guy who was running that scam actually was quite chatty. Yeah. And he's an entrepreneur from Nigeria that's actually started his own social network, and this was his plan for funding it, and he was a bit upset that there was going to be a write-up harming the reputation of his new upstarting social network. So perhaps not the best plan ever. So that was funny. But then the second thing was I had actually forgotten that Lockbit, the Lockbit ransomware, actually, you know, on the like screen where it says, hey, you've been ransomed, actually had a, hey, would you like to work for us if you provide access to your companies or other companies, we'll pay you. That's really innovative as well. Like doing it right on the lock screen, like good plan.
Yeah, exactly. It's, career opportunities. The career opportunities page that you always want on your splash screen. Good move. We got a Japanese insurer, their Singapore operation, also ransomwared. And that leads us.
Cyber insurer, no less, like yes. Insurer that sells cyber insurance policies. So,
yeah, well, a lot of them do now, right? So, yeah. But we got this story up from Tim Starks at CyberScoop, which is talking about, cyber insurance heading towards a crisis moment, which is something that we may have kind of predicted on the show a few times. But yes, it's the whole ransomware insurance thing, the cyber insurance thing, it's not really working out.
No, it's not. And, when the bosses of insurance companies are saying, look, the premiums are going to go up like 40% or whatever, and that's too much and it's bad. Like when they're complaining about it, you know, it's a problem. And I think they are seeing the signs that, you know, insuring against malice at a global scale without the kind of, you know, ability to diversify who you're insuring over a geographic space or whatever else to manage your risks. Turns out that's actually quite hard to do. You know, that's going to kind of change the market a little bit in terms of the willingness of insurers to sell the policies in the first place, the prices, what they'll cover, how much work they'll make you do to buy them, and indeed whether this industry is sustainable. I mean, that hospital, first hospital we talked about that had lost $100 billion in or so on, their insurance payout was 6.
Yeah.
Like 5.9 or something, and they lost, you know, 100 and whatever mil. You know, that's not a super useful insurance policy, you know, from the point of view of the hospitals.
Well, I think... was talking about this in Slack earlier today, and he said, I think it's going to fall over, and someone asked him why, and he said, because you can't insure against something that's guaranteed to happen.
Which, I mean, but exactly right. If your actuarial table says chance 1.0,
you probably don't want to offer insurance for
business
that.
But model doesn't work so well.
But I think, you know, this comes back to the age-old discussion about risk-based modeling for cyber incidents and how it kind of falls down, right? You can model against earthquakes. You can model against, tsunamis to a degree, although people don't always do that. But, you know, you can model against things that kind of have a statistical, you know, some statistical certainty around them. I remember something like 10 years ago, the US Department of Energy was looking at moving towards a risk-based security model for the physical security of nuclear weapons storage and asked the American Academy of Sciences to explore that as a concept. And the American Academy of Sciences services, which at that time on that project included Brian Snow, who was the former director of the Information Assurance Department of NSA, came back and basically said, hell no. And there is an unclassified portion of that report that, you know, you should be able to find out there on the internet. But the idea that you can use risk-based modeling to solve this stuff, it doesn't really work that well. And it is at the root of a lot of our problems.
Yeah, exactly. And that American Academy of Sciences paper, and in fact, we had Brian Snow on the show talking about that, yep. I seem to recall.
Yep.
And, you know, the conclusion was probabilistic risk assessment is the inappropriate methodology for modeling malicious risk.
Yes.
Full stop.
Yes.
End of paragraph.
That's right. And I wonder why insurance isn't doing so well.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. I briefly had faith that insurance was going to work. Like, about,
I know, to your eternal shame, because you bring it up every time we talk about insurance. I know. You're so ashamed.
Yeah, such a shame. But I mean, you know, maybe we'll see them go, hey, we'll run our own. Like, if an insurance firm went out and bought, you know, Mandiant and ran all of the incident responses and then required you to do all the things that, you know, all of the hardened.
Yeah,
you
you're
know,
stretching, buddy. Try yoga. You know, it ain't going to happen. I mean, although.
No, it's not.
That's
what it would take for it to work, you know?
Yeah, there are insurers who are demanding that their policyholders do certain things. There are even insurers that actually will send certain security devices to their customers, right? Like, there is already a bit of that happening, but I don't want them taking over Mandiant because they're going to make Mandiant suck, okay? Because they're the insurance industry. Let's just not. Be planting seeds like that, Adam. That's not a good
Sorry,
idea.
Mandiant. Sorry.
The FBI, meanwhile, is sending out alerts about affiliates, so which is a kind of interesting, right? Especially in light of Tom Uran's comments just earlier, that the FBI is starting to warn about affiliate crews who are known to use multiple different ransomware payloads and ransomware as a service providers. It kind of underscores what Tom was talking about.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense that we're starting to see this reflect more on the actual kind of real-world structure of how ransomware people operate, you know, that kind of, because we've talked a lot about the various kind of ways of the marketplace, you know, and all the innovations and great things that they're doing, and yeah, I guess the FBI is, you know, gradually catching up to that reality as well, and it's good for, you know, for people to get the message that this is quite a complicated, you know, it's not just one 400-pound Russian in their basement in St. Petersburg doing it all, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And meanwhile, ransomware crews are doing a pretty impressive job on closing the loop on implementing new-ish techniques into their attacks. They are using Proxy Shell, Petit Potam, and also Print Nightmare, according to these two stories, one from Cyberscoop, written by Sean Lingus, and the other from Catalin Kimpanu at The Record.
Yeah, and this is kind of funny because, you know, we've joked a bit about how ransomware crews emulate pen testers now. Like, they use tools that were designed for pen testing and red teaming. And originally, pen testing and red team was kind of trying to do the things that, and red teaming was trying to do the things that attackers would do. And so we ended up with, like, pen testers would emulate the attackers. Now the attackers emulate the pen testers. And the funny thing is that the attackers are now doing more volume than the pen testers are and are now starting to kind of get, you know, like, they're using these bugs and these, you know, proof of contents and concepts that come out faster than a professional pen test team would.
Yeah, because, so your team's looking at this and getting impressed. Is that pretty much
right? Like, the speed of taking a POC and being out there using it in the wild and being confident and have all of your kind of, you know, playbooks and methodologies and understanding OPSEC risks and all that kind of calculus that you do, you know, when you're operating in someone's environment. Yeah, I feel like the criminals are now doing it faster, which perhaps means that we're back to emulating them again. So I guess good.
Yeah. It's, what is it? I've always said it's life imitating art.
Yes, exactly. Now we're a couple of cycles around that sort of, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's time is a flat circle, man. What have we got here? Now, look, let's talk about another crime type, which, funnily enough, is responsible for generating more losses than ransomware. The thing that makes ransomware catastrophic is the business disruption, less so than the pure dollar impact. That is not the case for BEC, which is purely about financial losses. We've got a nice little write-up here from NBC Boston about a New Hampshire town being defrauded of $2.3 million in taxpayer money through a BEC scam.
Yeah, it just goes to show. I mean, there's a reason why it's still on the top of a whole bunch of the money things. Like, it's a well-worn avenue of being able to take people's money away. And, you know, I guess the awareness of this type of fraud is a little higher than it was, but, you know, it's still pretty straightforward to do.
Yeah, it is. What else have we got here? 2000 Exchange bot. Man, Microsoft's having a bad time. They're having a bad year.
Having a bad time.
Yeah, 2000 Exchange boxes are being hacked with that proxy shell exploit.
Yeah, Orange Size talk at Black Hat with DEFCON went down pretty well, and he talked about a bunch about the bugs and his methodology for approaching Exchange. But yes, these bugs are very real, and you know, surveys of the IPv4 address space do suggest that there's, you know, still pretty, you know, quite a few tens of thousands Exchange boxes that are vulnerable, and they're all getting owned.
I mean, there are patches available for this, right? But you know, I know of one organization. It's an example I've mentioned on the show a few times, that when the first round of Exchange bugs were out and being exploited, they actually had to stand up a project internally to locate the Exchange boxes, you know, and actually find them so that they could either patch them or power them down. And mostly it was an eradication sort of search and destroy project. But what a mess, you know, what a mess.
Yeah, and I mean, especially for stuff like Exchange that's just been in there for a very long time, and whatever contractors or people that built these things have moved on. And yeah, you can certainly understand how these things get, you know, kind of abandoned to become just kind of part of the, you know, of the furniture around the big network.
Catalan at The Record also has a story up about a group called AltDos, which is doing a bunch of intrusions against targets in Southeast Asia. The reason I find this one interesting is, you know, we've seen a lot of economic growth in the last 20, 30 years in Southeast Asia. And people who work in security in Australia and New Zealand have had, a lot of them have had exposure to what networks look like in Southeast Asian countries, particularly some of the poorer countries like, you know, Indonesia, the Philippines, etc. And you know, it is a target-rich environment. Let's just put it that way. So I'm guessing there's going to be some drama in the future.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this crew seems to be attacking a bunch of targets, so mostly Thailand and Singapore and some of the things we've seen attributed strongly, but a bunch of other targets around the region. And I guess it's kind of, this one's interesting just because they are a bit chaotic, right? There's, you know, ransoming, there's stealing data and releasing it without bothering to go through the ransoming phase, like just publish it straight away, some selling it, some in cases following it up with denial of service as well, just to put a bit of pressure on. So yeah, pretty chaotic actor, but seems constrained to Southeast Asia, which is an interesting kind of, you know, the idea of a, you know, regional specific actors to understand the local nuances and the local targets. I guess that's a good niche.
Now we've got a write-up from Kim Zetter, courtesy of her excellent newsletter Zero Day, which people should absolutely subscribe to if they have not. And they're looking at, you know, Iran seems to be having trouble with hacktivists. Whether real or not, we don't know. They could be hacktivists. They could be people working at GCHQ, for all we know. But someone has obtained access, apparently, right? Like, we can't independently verify this, but there is a bunch of video out there now purporting to come from a fairly nasty Iranian regime prison, you know, showing people being beaten, etc. But there is a wonderful bit of footage there where they start changing all of the screens in their, like, surveillance room to some sort of, you know, we owned you message. So that's pretty cool. You know, this is after Iran's train network screens got owned, and, you know, there's stuff happening there. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, it is certainly clear that something is up, and you know, the attributes of the story in terms of, you know, knowing exactly what happened, obviously, is still a bit vague. But the story suggests that someone broke into, at the very least, the surveillance camera networks in the prison. They've released individual footage, you know, from around the prison. But yeah, that particular scene of the monitoring office being like movie hacked, It's pretty, I mean, it's pretty funny.
It is. You didn't appreciate my joke when I said it was GCHQ, when we know if it was another country, it was almost certainly a different one, but you know.
82. Yes, it might be. It might indeed be that. But no, it's just funny because that was, you know, kind of talking about it being the screen that came up, you know, which, A, very movie hacking, very good kind of optics, very compelling, which is one of the things that makes a point to a professional operation, although obviously hacktivists can be professionals too. But yeah, having a, you know, something that's going to go viral like that, of the screens all blinking orange, then changing to a message, you know, and gradually around the room, and then watching the guys, you know, who's sitting there, you know, kind of waiting for his shift to be up, twiddling his thumbs, watching the screens gradually change and seeing his reaction, and all the colleagues come in and take pictures for their Instagrams or whatever. You know, that's, it makes for great content, and that makes it seem perhaps well thought through. But yeah, the screens, you know, talk about the prison being a stain on the beard of the leader or something like that. And we saw that previous thing with the train station screens being hijacked. They were putting up like the Ayatollah's phone number or something like that. So, I mean, these are pretty pointed kind of,
yeah,
they operations,
are.
You know.
They are. But I mean, look, it just, I think we are entering the phase in this whole thing where we will start to see genuine activism of this kind. And funnily enough, you know, we were just having a conversation about life imitating art. It could be that this is a government-led action, but that could result in the real thing. Do you know what I mean? And then we go around that circle again.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly. And I'm constantly surprised that we don't see more really solid, you know, pure activism. You would have thought, you know, environmentalists or, I mean, I guess maybe some of the tax document leaks and stuff. We don't know whether that was activists or whether that was somebody else or whatever. But I'm surprised we don't see more effective activist hacking, like real activist hacking, as opposed to, you know, people pretending to be a cutting sort of justice or whatever.
Yeah, or the guardians of peace.
Yes.
Now, in some other news, I think last time we ran the show, we were like, oh, look, Apple's withdrawn its DMCA complaint against Corellium because it knew it was going to lose. It already lost its previous part of its complaint, which was the more, you know, serious of the two actions, the one that stood a better chance. That actually got tossed, but now they're appealing that part. So it looks like Apple is opening this whole thing up again. I really hope they have their ass handed to them because they deserve it. And good luck convincing a court that the previous judge erred.
Yeah, exactly. This is not a great look for Apple. I know we talked last time about, you know, how they, you know, how this had already reflected kind of poorly on them, and we were glad that they had put this behind them. But no, they apparently haven't. So I guess whichever bit of Apple is responsible for this probably doesn't listen to the show.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was the whole thing too, where they were saying that people should independently verify their claims with regard to on-device scanning for child sex abuse material. This is something they've said. Oh, people could go, security researchers can have a look at it. And now they're suing Corellium. And, you know, this is, which is a tool that would let people do that, right? So Patrick Howell O'Neill for MIT Technology Review has written up that angle. And I got to say, he did a really good job. That's the story to read on this one.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a great write-up and interviews with people from Corellium and around, you know, other researchers. And yeah, it really does kind of juxtapose Apple's, you know, the statements of one part of Apple about this and then, you know, them suing Corellium again or appealing the previous case of it again. It just kind of looks dumb. And the, you know, the fact that Corellium really is the only credible option other than the traditional approach of buying dodgy dev hardware or underground stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty on the nose.
Tom Brewster at Forbes managed to score himself quite the scoop of an interview. He spoke to the gentleman who runs Positive Technologies about their whole situation. Positive Technologies, of course, has been sanctioned by the United States for allegedly participating in all sorts of naughty business involving the Russian intelligence services. Of course, you know, this CEO comes out and says, of course, that's all ridiculous. You know, we are a bunch of fluffy bunnies. And, you know, there's no way that we can know whether or not Yuri Maximov is telling the truth or whether the US government is telling the truth, but they both can't be telling the truth. Let's put it that way.
And one of these organizations can levy sanctions and the other one, you know, gets to drive his Lamborghini presumably around and that's about it. And, you know, okay, fair enough. Although I don't know if Lamborghinis are also sanctionable. But yeah, it's certainly an interesting insight. I mean, you know, their relationship with the, you know, Russian security services, it does certainly exist. They've been doing some work for them. They say it's kind of defensive work, but, you know, how do these things really happen? And kind of regardless of what he says, they still got themselves sanctioned. So maybe a bit, you know, what are you going to do, right?
Now I want to talk about a bit of research. So the story here, this is another Catalan one. The story here is that this exfiltration technique applies to Cisco devices, and that's the story. And this is, they're talking about an exfiltration technique that was first disclosed about a year ago called SNICAT. And I missed it then. And I'm glad this story has turned up because it meant that I could read about SNICAT, which is a really, really interesting way to exfil data from a network through TLS break and inspect devices. Adam, please tell the listeners how SNICAT works.
So when you're making a TLS connection, you know, off to a web server or something, in the old days you did it via IP address and there was one IP address per web server and that obviously became a problem. These days we have a TLS extension called SNI server name indication where the client making an outbound connection says, I'm connecting to this IP address, and when I get there, I would like to talk to this particular DNS name. And that's how things like Cloudflare or Google's proxies or Amazon or whatever, you know, figure out which of the many, many thousands of servers behind them.
That's basically why we can run the entire internet if we had to on about 5 IP addresses.
Yeah, exactly. It's why IPv4 is still viable, pretty much that, and carrier NAT. And so this is using that SNI mechanism, which of course is in the very first you know, kind of parts of the TLS connection stand up. It's using that as an exfil channel, stick the data in the SNI request, send out the connection. And it's interesting, and this means that for like TLS break and inspect boxes, typically they're going to go out, make the connection to the final destination on behalf of the end user, because they need to go and get the certificate to be able to kind of go present that back to the user. And you send the SNI kind of hello message saying who you want to talk to before you get the certificate back from the end server, because the end server has to know what certificate to give it to you. So necessarily the middle box can't actually kind of complete the handshake with its other client without going out and talking to the real server and passing on the SNI. So great place to go stick some data, and who cares about the rest of the connection? You can just let that get torn down, whatever, doesn't matter. You can exfil some data like that. So yeah, pretty cool technique for sticking stuff straight out through a security device.
But I think the interesting thing here is that these blue coat or whatever devices, I don't know if blue coat's specifically affected, but you know what I mean, these middleware boxes, they don't raise any alarms. They don't monitor anything until the TLS handshake is actually completed. So you can just throw a whole bunch of data, you can exfil it through the SNI field and just not complete the TLS handshake. And even when these things are configured to throw data out of like a, you know, special pseudo span port into an IDS, it's still won't throw anything because the handshake's not completed. So it's a really stealthy technique. It's very cool.
Yeah, I mean, these, you know, things are primarily designed to control content rather than kind of metadata, which is sort of what this is, what this is addressing data. And you kind of see, like, historically, that's kind of what they were caring about, was the inside of the connection, not the, you know, kind of transport. So you can kind of, you know, especially when some of these engines, you know, have been around for a while, you know, they were designed to do a particular thing 5-10 years ago, and SNI is a kind of new bolted on sort of thing, and you can kind of see why no one would have thought of this. So yeah, smart work.
You can, but it's going to be real easy to spot if you're looking for it. That's the downside.
Yeah, certainly now, like, it's one of these things, once you know to look for it, then obviously, yeah, kind of weird looking SNI data and kind of that high entropy.
Well, yeah, and just not even that, but just like the sheer volume of TLS connections you would need to initiate to smuggle anything more than a text file out, you know, like.
Yes.
That's going to be pretty cool. But I just thought it was cool research. A lot of hay being made about some bugs affecting. So there was a bunch of like IoT, pretty serious, like, you know, mem corruption bugs unveiled in April. Turns out these bugs apply to QNX, which is the BlackBerry real-time operating system. It's used in a lot of applications. Like my Toyota head unit in my Prado is a QNX-based head unit, right? It's used in all sorts of places where you might not know it is. So you're getting a lot of hot takes saying that this is the end of the world, but obviously, this is really going to depend on what particular device you're talking about is using QNX, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, QNX is super prevalent in embedded systems, but a lot of embedded systems, you know, either aren't directly internet connected or, you know, they're on local, you know, in the network inside your car. Probably not a super hostile environment, you know, unless you've also then bridged that onwards to the internet through some kind of, you know, manufacturers, you know, car manufacturers thing or some third party thing. So, you know, these devices are everywhere, you know, in your printer or wherever else, but the chance that the network stack or input through these systems is exposed to an attacker is kind of what means the planet doesn't melt every time there's an IoT, you know, embedded operating system bug. And we've seen, you know, the similar things with VxWorks and a bunch of the other kind of embedded system operating systems. And, you know, if you put them on the internet, you put them in your router, you put them in a, you know, in a car that's always connected to the internet, then okay, yes, maybe bad times. But, you know, your medical, you know, injection pumps or whatever, chances are probably not on the internet. So,
yeah, I mean, for me, that wasn't one that I saw that I thought was terrible, but one that I did see and I thought, was this next one, right? And it's really interesting because I'd flagged this story for this week's show prior to anything happening beyond this. But the story from the Daily Swig said, Realtek SDK vulnerabilities impact dozens of downstream IoT vendors. This is written by Stephen Pritchard for the Daily Swig. And I thought, geez, man, that Realtek stuff is connected and it is everywhere. And this one's going to be a problem, which is what I planned to say this week. But then we got another story here, also from The Record, which the headline is hundreds of thousands of Realtek-based devices under attack from IoT botnets. So yeah, that prediction kind of panned out.
Yeah, it certainly did. I mean, this is a great example of kind of, you know, embedded system on a chip with an SDK provided by a manufacturer, you know, Realtek, which is then used by the actual equipment manufacturers to build and integrate their products. And it's very, very hard as a consumer or a network admin or a security person to know, you know, whether a random IP camera or wireless router or whatever else includes the vulnerable code, the vulnerable configuration, whether the prerequisites are met, it's really, really difficult until someone builds a botnet and goes and does it.
Yeah,
to everything, and then you find out. So they're kind of doing you a service in a way of triaging the bug and figuring out how it works, and then letting you know by virtue of owning you and mining, you know, Bitcoin, Dogecoin on your cameras.
But if you look at the just the list in this record story of the affected devices, there are quite a lot of them.
I mean, in fact, I am literally recording this show across a vulnerable device.
Yeah,
right now, I was looking at the, you know, wireless router. I'm like, oh yeah, that's the one in the next room that we're talking to.
Yeah, wow. I'm literally just looking at the list now, sort of running a bit of a mental inventory. But yes. It's bad.
Asset that one's management, bad. Man. It's important.
But it was clear, like, and they describe Realtek as little known, but very popular. It's not little known, man.
It's not.
You know, Realtek is just everywhere. I mean, you know, you can probably picture their little logo.
The little crabby guy.
The little crabby guy on the logo. Yeah, exactly.
I'm making the crabby hands for the people at home. I'm making crabby hands right now.
Now, we're actually going to talk about some research that you did. It was you and your team over there at CyberCX. So a lot of listeners would remember that when we were talking about Excellion and we were talking about the Excellion, you know, secure file gateway or whatever they called it, Adam seemed a little bit triggered every time we would talk about Excellion. And that's because at the time he was doing a bunch of research into their secure file gateway replacement product, which is called Kiteworks. And there were shells. There were some shells.
Yep, there were some shells. You know, we were looking at this product after, you know, there was obviously a bunch of Excellion STAs that got themselves compromised last year.
File transfer appliance. That was what I was looking for. Not such a secure file gateway, but anyway, go on.
Well, I'm sure it's secure. But anyway, we were looking at Kiteworks, the replacement product, and we had a couple of engagements to examine those. And we got some good bugs. We got essentially the equivalent bugs to what got FTA owned, some SQL injection, like post-auth SQL injection bugs, and then, you know, a few other things to kind of bug chain that up. And the net result of this was any user to remote root code exec through a chain of, you know, like SQLi to escalate privilege, and then SQLi to turn off the whitelisting of where you can reach the ABIN interfaces, and then some cross-site request forgery to talk to a vulnerable, you know, arbitrary file read to pull out the key material to make API calls to do code exec, and then a local privesc via, you know, Comedy Unix file system permissions to make it into root. And yeah, that's quite an effective bug chain. When they put it all together like that.
There was some fancy footwork involved, though. Like, they clearly did step it up between and this. But I still, you sort of think that maybe they, you know, there's a few points here that you shouldn't have been able to progress past.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, it is definitely a lot improved. I mean, I've spent quite a lot of time over the years inside the FTA code base as well, because that always gave out shells, and they were certainly harder work.
Yeah.
In Kiteworks than they were in FTA, but, you know, that's also a result of it being a little bit more recent. But yes, I mean, in the end, you know, we managed to pop some shells, and the bugs are at least as good as the ones that, you know, caused the widespread FTA compromises. But anyway, they've been patched. They reported to Excellion earlier on, you know, kind of January, February, March this year, and they have been patched. So if you're running up to date Kiteworks, you should be fine from these bugs.
You also disclosed some bugs in Fortinet as well.
Oh, yeah. One of my other colleagues had a sweet pre-auth remote code exec against Fortinet's FortiPortal, which is the management product for, like, if you sell... it's the management product for managing big fleets of Fortinet, like WAN and VPN devices. So if you're a telco or, you know, a company that does kind of managed networking services, this is the thing that you expose to the internet so that your customers can self-provision VPNs and WAN stuff. So by design, exposed to the internet. So there's also, we write up on our blog about that particular set of bugs, but that came down to Apache Tomcat with default creds.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The world is fine. The world is fine. Yes.
It's only a security appliance. It's fine.
It's only a security appliance that's designed to control the other security appliances.
Yes, so. And designed to go on the internet.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
To be fair, they had restricted access to the, like, Tomcat admin service to localhost so that you couldn't do this and it wouldn't matter that the default creds were default creds. But then they put Apache in reverse proxy in front of it, and now it's coming, all requests are coming from localhost because it's going through the reverse proxy. So yeah, Not so great.
Not so great. We've got a bit of research written up here on the record about, and this is very interesting, actually. We can't spend too much time on this because we are actually running massively over time. But yeah, it is super interesting. TCP-based DDoS amplification attacks. And it's like, oh, hello, how?
This is some great research, man. So this is traffic amplification DDoS through spoofed TCP connections. And the trick here is, because normally in TCP you can't spoof it because the three-way handshake has to complete before anything really happens. This is attacking middle boxes, so TLS, intercept proxies, you know, everything else that's in the middle, you know, IDS, IPSs, anything that's in the middle of the connection and doesn't do proper like TCP state tracking, that, you know, like, so not a full application layer proxy. And a lot of these, you know, kind of inline appliances that are doing inspection are designed for speed. They have to run at wire speed, and they do so by taking a bunch of shortcuts in the TCP state processing. And so this is some research where they figured out combinations of kind of non-normal TCP state that would trigger a response from inline box that was doing some kind of filtering. So the canonical example would be talking to some kind of, you know, filtering firewall that wants to say no. So you request some blocked site through it with a badly formed TCP connection that was never going to work, but the middle box doesn't know that. And then it responds with a, you can't go to, you know, risky.biz because it's a hacker site, generates a big response.
Yeah, it actually throws a bunch of HTML back, which is just wicked.
Yeah. And so a classic example of why being in the middle of that state and trying to break the end-to-endness of TCP is a bad idea. And now you end up with weird kind of canonicalization bugs between the two network stacks. And yeah, net result is send a well-formed TCP SYN and some content with some weird flags, get a response going to the source IP address of that packet without ever having done the three-way handshake, and then use that for denial of service, reflected, you know, amplified denial of service. That's super smart.
It is.
And I am amazed that this hasn't happened before. And the researchers who did it then scanned the entire internet to enumerate vulnerable middle systems that do this. And it turns out a bunch of the Chinese firewall and other kind of states that are doing filtering are vulnerable to this. And of course, they can't really fix it because they have to do it at country scale, and they're not probably going to get super great support from Blue Code or whoever now, sanctions, whatever. So this is a really interesting and potentially quite practical avenue to do bad stuff. So
yeah, because the amplification you get is just massive. So to all the CISOs listening, I hope you're going to enjoy being DDoSed by the Great Firewall of China.
I know, right? So good. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Yeah.
What are you
going to do? So there will be blood. There will be blood.
So good.
Let's whiz through the last few here. Trend Micro has patched a couple of ODAs in its Apex One EDR platform. It says hackers tried to exploit these bugs, so I don't know what the story is there, and they're being a bit tight-lipped, but we have seen Chinese APT crews targeting Trend products before, and it is interesting to note that Trend does have a substantial customer base in Japan, so I'm guessing, you know, maybe there's something going on there.
And local privacy in your EDR is, you know, that's a bit orcs.
Well, it is, right? But like, if you think Trend's the only one that has crappy parsers, like, this is all, we've been waiting for this for a long time. It's coming. We've also got a post from the Daily Swig that points out, it actually looks at the Great Firewall of China and points out that it's like operating at such scale that it's starting to interfere with DNS resolvers like outside of the Great Firewall of China. So that's a bit of interesting research. You read that one, yeah?
Yeah, because of caching and other stuff. And this is some good work from Citizen Lab that are kind of monitoring, you know, the behavior of the Great Firewall to be able to understand what's going on and what's being blocked and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it's funny that there's sort of collateral damage outside of China.
Yeah, it is. Now, we're just going to finish with a bad joke, courtesy of a listener, Benno, aka Gmland on Twitter, who said they will donate $50 to a charity of my choice if I put this joke in the show. The joke is, and it's presented in meme form, how did the CISO leave the company? He ran somewhere. Hey, man. Now we just got to think of a good cause, right?
Is there like a bad jokes burn unit charity?
My friend, that's actually it for this week's news. Extra long one, of course. It always is when it's our first show back after a break. Thanks a lot for joining us, and all the best in lockdown over there in New Zealand. And, you know, let's all just power through, I guess.
Yep. And we'll be back next week for yet more lulls and terrible things happening. So I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is on to this week's sponsor interview now with Dan Guido and Evan Saltanik of Trail of Bits. Trail of Bits is a security engineering firm, and it's been doing a bunch of research into the security of what I would call the machine learning model supply chain. It turns out everyone is sharing these models as Python pickle files, and that, Trail of Bits says, is less than ideal. Dan Guido and Evan Saltanik join me to talk about the security issues present in the world of machine learning models, and I'll drop you in here. And the first voice you hear is Dan Guido's.
A lot of people think about machine learning as like, how do I use machine learning to like write better exploits? But instead, how we're thinking about it at Trail of Bits is that there's this wide variety of software out there used to do machine learning for, you know, business tasks, things that companies need, that are widely vulnerable to all kinds of new uncharted attacks that we can discover in this massive blue ocean, this massive green field. So that's really motivating to me. That's really exciting to me. And that's something that we've been focusing the attention of the company on for the last, I think, honestly, a few years now.
Yeah. So what in particular are you looking at? Now, I know some of the work is looking at the software tools that are used in like the machine learning supply chain, right? Like looking at the libraries that parse a lot of this data and looking, you know, bug hunting there, right? So that's one aspect to it. But you're also doing some of the fun stuff around getting a little bit adversarial, I understand. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, of course. So there's a bunch of different ways to approach this, but I think the big win that we have at Trail of Bits is we can combine the software security expertise that we have with the machine learning expertise that we've also got. And that's where I think there's a blind spot in the industry. There's only a few people that have really discovered the overlap between those two fields. You see this, like there's a paper out of the University of Maryland called Summoning Demons, which was about how to use software security issues to trick and fool various machine learning systems. But we've also done the same thing with a whole software supply chain that people use to build models, to transfer models, to share models between each other. And it's been fruitful. Like we found really systemic issues that cut across the entire industry of people writing machine learning tools.
Well, I mean, there's a whole bunch of this stuff is open source and used very widely and hasn't had much of attention. So I would imagine that, yeah, it's pretty fertile ground, right?
Absolutely. I think the real like key thing to remember here too is that a lot of these machine learning folks, they're people that are trained to do statistics, they're trained to do data, they're trained to do math. They're not exactly people that are trained to do computer science, and they haven't had the exposure to security that the rest of us in, you know, this field probably have. So a lot of these kind of bugs, they're very superficial, they're very easy to spot, and they've woven their way into many of the tools that people use without anyone really blinking an eye. The one that I'm really referring to right now, which is one of them that we've made public, we've got a few more incubating, but one of them that we've made public was this fact that if you're a machine learning researcher and you want to share your model with somebody else, you pickle it and you send it to them. And I think that this would automatically trigger a bunch of alarm bells for most security engineers because they remember that like pickling can have arbitrary Python code inside of it. And that when you load a pickle from somebody else you don't trust, they can execute code on your machine. Well, it turns out that foundationally, pickles are built into the entire ecosystem of machine learning.
Yeah. So just before we get into that, because we're joined by one of your colleagues, Evan Saltanik, who's going to talk a little bit more about that. You've also done some work into like messing with the data that goes into that feeds into some of these models and doing some more adversarial machine learning. Can you tell us a bit about that work?
Yeah, sure. So same thing here. Like, I think that there's been a lot of like research about what you call model extraction attacks, model inversion attacks, things like membership inference. These are these classic kind of machine learning attacks that people discuss in literature. But just the same way that you see in the software fields where like people, academics writing about software exploitation techniques is kind of like very funny for industry people to read about because they're like discovering how to do ROP all over again. And then they do it against some kind of like very weakened system, like they're using Red Hat Linux 6 or something really old to perform their attacks. What we did is we took a lot of the techniques that people had discussed in literature and we built a framework for very easily applying them to a restricted threat model. So what I mean by that is, let's assume that you have a machine learning system in the sky somewhere, in the cloud somewhere, and the only thing it gives back to you is yes and no answers, depending on some, you know, whatever. Is this a face, right? And what our framework does, it's called Privacy Raven, is it lets you script up an attack against that API in just about like 15 lines of code in Python. And then it can perform these attacks that were previously much more theoretical. So it can perform membership inference attacks, it can perform model extraction attacks, and it can do it automatically. So like the simplest analogy here is that Privacy Raven is Metasploit for machine learning. And we've been adding features to it continuously as time goes on. So it allows you to perform a lot of these things where you can reconstitute a machine learning model like on your computer that used to be accessible behind some API that charged you a cent every time you executed against it.
Well, once you've enumerated the model, then you can start messing with it, right? Like messing with it, throwing some different stuff at it and seeing how it changes.
Yeah, I mean, you can evaluate the model for all kinds of security issues with it. Or you could use it for intellectual property theft. Like maybe somebody else has trained a model that you could use in your product and you want to take it from them. So you can pound against their API using Privacy Raven to reconstitute that model for yourself. Like maybe you're creating the substitute model and it's only 80 or 90% accurate to what the remote one was, but that might be good enough for you.
Now we're joined by Evan Sultanik, your colleague, who's done a lot of the work on this. So Evan, you know, what do you have to add here? I mean, I'm guessing for you, just based on a conversation we had prior, that the sort of interesting slash alarming bit for you was just sort of how brittle the supply chain of tools used in this field is.
Exactly. So my work has particularly been focusing on more traditional security attacks against the supply chain, and really focusing on the low-hanging fruit. In many cases, you don't need to even employ these exotic machine learning or adversarial machine learning.
No, it'd be like memory corruption, 1990s style, straight into some crappy library thrown together by an academic. I mean, that's, and I've been waiting for someone to do this, right? Because like this whole field seems to be coalescing around a bunch of different sort of tool sets and libraries, and it doesn't feel like they've had a lot of attention.
That's correct. In fact, as Dan alluded to, the majority of tools out there are built on top of Python and use Python pickling for their serialization of models. And it makes a lot of sense. That makes life a lot easier for the developer. It's built into the Python runtime. However, for whatever reason, this has been included as the de facto way that models are serialized across a plethora of machine learning libraries. And yet we know in the security community that pickling is inherently unsafe. What we have done is created a number of proof of concepts and a tool that allows one to examine existing machine learning models to check for certain classes of malice that might be embedded into them, as well as inject arbitrary code into machine learning models that can be run surreptitiously when that model is loaded. And there are actually websites out there that are dedicated to sharing these models. Because in many cases in machine learning, the model itself is considered a sort of a free byproduct of the machine learning process. And in many cases, you can share, you're willing to share the model, but the real intellectual property isn't the model itself. It is the corpora and the algorithms you use to create it.
Yeah.
Right. We see this with a lot of natural language processing models. We see this with image classification models. And so people share these with each other almost freely. And there a number of the machine learning libraries will actually even automatically download models from GitHub when you try and load a new
So this is like the invocation problem. I guess it's somewhere between PyPy and WordPress themes, sort of like a beautiful combination between those two issues.
Exactly. So there's a whole space of like typo squatting attacks that haven't really been explored and maybe exploited right now, and we aren't even aware of them. But what we've been looking at is the actual encoding of the models. And
So it's less about attacking the things that are parsing those models when you don't really need to, when you can just throw arbitrary Python into them, I guess.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
So when we have demonstrated this to machine learning practitioners, oftentimes they're flabbergasted. They had no idea that this was possible with what they otherwise thought was, you know, a PyTorch model or some other file format that they didn't expect to be able to run executable code. So what you can do whatever you want. You can exfiltrate all of the files in the local directory where the model is being run, presumably including algorithms and proprietary corpora and whatnot.
So, I mean, I guess what you're saying is it would be fairly easy to, infiltrate these model repos and collect as you go, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it can also be... The attacks can be very subtle. So, for example, you could create a model that behaves differently depending on the locale in which it's run, the IP address, the local language that's set on the server that it's being run on. And it can behave one way in one place and another way in another place.
So, Dan, quite often Trailer Bits releases tools. Is this something that you'll be throwing out there in a limited form, or is this more just stuff that you're working on internally for use on engagements?
Oh, of course. Like the rest of our research, the vast majority of it is already public. So we have a GitHub project. It's called Fickling. And just like any other project from Trailer Bits, we've tried to go over the top to make it as useful as possible. So Fickling is a symbolic version of the Pickle virtual machine. And it allows you to evaluate very specifically all of the effects that a Pickle file might have on a person's local system.
So it's like a sandbox analyzer, but for machine learning Pickle files.
Yeah, but it does that and it does more. And wait, there's more. So what the other things that Fickling can do is, besides evaluating Pickle files that you download for potential maliciousness, we can also use it to decompile existing Pickle files to read them by hand and understand what's inside. And we can use it to modify and inject malicious code into previously good Pickle files. So this is it's a defensive tool and it's an offensive tool. It's something that red teamers can use if they'd like to perform these attacks against machines that they're responsible for, or it's something that people can build into their sharing systems, like these websites that just share models all over the place, or that they can put in front of kind of a system that consumes these as a purpose.
So it really sounds like I was just a little bit off base earlier when thinking this would be attacks against the software actually parsing these files, when ultimately what you guys have done here is just a bit of work on manipulating those files that people are sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is like the natural end, I think, for this area of research, because it is really, it's like a shallow issue, right? Like you got the nail on the head that like, okay, well, everybody uses Pickles. Well, like, what can you do about it? Well, we can write this tool called Fickling, and it statically analyzes Pickles, it decompiles Pickles, and it inserts malicious files into Pickles, right? Obviously, the real solution here is to convince people not to use Pickle as a format. We want people to use something different, a little bit safer. Dare I say JSON or CBOR or protobufs, or like literally anything in the universe would be better than Pickles. But in lieu of that, we realize that that's going to be a really massive shift, that a lot of these libraries and a lot of these ecosystems and machine learning as a service things and like everyone else is going to have to do. So we're kind of just stuck with Pickles for a while. And the only real solution that is apparent is a tool like Fickling, like what we made.
Yeah. Or, I mean, could modifying the software that these, files are used by to discard... I mean, it gets a bit tricky then, isn't it? You either respect the format or you don't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really difficult to just say that, we're just going to mess with it. We're like, convert it to one format and convert it back. Like back in the old days when you were afraid to open a Word document or something, you could convert it to an open office document and then convert it back to a Word document.
Yeah.
And, like, maybe it would get rid of the bad stuff. But you can't really do that here.
Evan Saltanik, Dan Guido, thank you so much for joining me to talk through this research. It sounds very interesting, and I'll drop a link into that GitHub in the show notes. Cheers.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having us again.
Thanks a lot.
That was Dan Guido and Evan Saltanik there from Trail of Bits. Big thanks to them for that, and big thanks to Trail of Bits for being a long-term sponsor of this program. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a few days with a soapbox interview with Ryan Callumber from Proofpoint. That is a fun one because he basically just joined me for a Microsoft kicking session. So yeah, that'll be up soon. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.